Hi, thanks for checking out Press Play and our podcast. And when you're done with this one, I have another one that you're going to love. I just know it. It's a podcast about design and architecture, cars, gadgets, all sorts of things that make up our built and beautiful world. It's hosted by someone who is an insider who knows everything about design and architecture, Frances Anderton. And the podcast is called DNA. It's on KCRW's iTunes page, so check it out.
You are entering into the most dangerous country on Earth. Kim Jong-un's people believe anything he tells them, including that he can speak to dolphins or he doesn't urinate and defecate.
Whoa. You tell me my man doesn't pee or poo?
Everybody pees and poos. Where would he go otherwise? He'd explode.
But he does talk to dolphins.
Is it possible that North Korea hacked Sony Pictures computers because they're miffed about the new Seth Rogen comedy, The Interview? We'll take a look at the impact of that hack in just a moment. But first, today's Supreme Court arguments over what rights pregnant women have in the workplace. Peggy Young was a driver for UPS when she got pregnant 8 years ago. Her doctor said she shouldn't lift anything over 20 pounds. After she told UPS that, she was put on unpaid leave for 7 months, so she lost her income, her health, and her pension benefits. So Young sued UPS, and the Supreme Court heard arguments in the case this morning. Dahlia Lithwick is senior editor and legal correspondent at Slate.com. Hi, Dahlia.
Hi there, Madeline.
Well, the job description for a UPS driver says you need to be able to lift 70 pounds. Peggy Young was not able to do that when she was pregnant. So what was her argument against UPS's decision to put her on leave?
Well, her argument was that she was what's called an air driver for UPS. She was mostly doing a run to and from the airport, lifting light envelopes, that in fact she almost never had to lift even the 20 pounds that her doctor had said she couldn't lift. And so she really could have continued on in her job indefinitely, except that UPS said she couldn't. And she also said, and this is, I think, the core of the case, that UPS, when other people are reassigned based on injuries at the company, they're given what's called light lifting duties or office jobs or clerical work in the interim, and the UPS wouldn't afford her that. So in effect, she said, they made no effort to accommodate me. They would have accommodated anyone else, any other worker, male or female, who was, for instance, injured on the job. And so really the nut of her argument is that UPS's policy is to treat pregnant people worse than other injured workers.
And so what was UPS's argument in that case, that pregnancy wasn't a disability?
Well, partly that. They simply say, you know, and this whole case arises under something called the Pregnancy Discrimination Act that was passed by Congress in 1978. It amended Title VII of the Civil Rights Act, really responding to a Supreme Court ruling that had come before that slightly fatuously found that pregnant women were not protected under laws that prohibit sex discrimination, because pregnancy, in the Supreme Court's view in that prior case, pregnancy has nothing to do with gender. So the PDA really amended the civil rights laws to say, yes, you cannot, in fact, discriminate against women affected by pregnancy, and you have to make sure that you're comparing them to other persons in similar in their ability or inability to work, says the statute. And so this case comes up because she says, compare me to all those other workers that you put on light lift accommodations. And what UPS says, just to answer your question, is no, she's not like them. She wasn't injured on the job. There's no reason that she needs to be accommodated in this way. In effect, what UPS says is, we're not anti-pregnant women. We're pregnancy neutral. And the pregnancy neutral policy does not violate civil rights statutes.
So the UPS has since changed its policy, which makes it more accommodating to women who are pregnant and need to alter their work duties. However, how did the court react today? How did the justices react today to their argument that they were simply following the law?
Well, I think they had two problems today at the court. One is this case never went to trial. And so there are huge factual disputes that never got resolved because this case was dismissed on what's called summary judgment. The court just said, sorry, Ms. Young, you lose, and the appeals court agreed. And so there was an awful lot of factual fighting amongst the justices and counsel today that really highlighted the fact that if this case had gone to trial, if we actually had a record, if we actually knew whether people, for instance, Justice Sam Alito kept saying, if you're injured driving your ATV around on the weekends, does UPS accommodate you? And one lawyer said, sure they do. And another lawyer said, no, they don't. And because we don't have a factual record, those issues don't get resolved. And that was very frustrating. I think the other thing that happened today was that the justices were very, very unclear on who the statute compares Ms. Young to. It was not clear at all to them that there's what Justice Kagan kept calling the comparator, who the class of people that we should be looking at to say, is this analogous to Ms. Young? That was very, very, very fuzzy for the justices. I would say the argument was completely technical and utterly confusing.
Yeah, it sounds pretty confusing. The part of the law I understand that they were arguing over was this one clause that says that pregnant workers are entitled to the same treatment in the workplace as non-pregnant employees who are, quote, similar in their ability or inability to work. So that seems pretty vague.
Well, it's not only vague, but literally there was at least 10 minutes, Madeline, on a semicolon that separates those two clauses. And it seems to me that when you have Justice Kagan parsing a semicolon, you know you're kind of down the rabbit hole. But I think the important thing for the court is that they recognize that this is either going to broadly sweep an awful lot of people into getting accommodations, and that's why the business community really opposes Young's petition to the court, or alternatively, it could really harm pregnant women. And I think that, you know, it's so important you look at the statistics around this case. You know, women make up 47% of the labor force. 62% of women have given birth, were in the labor force in the prior year. Women are primary breadwinners in 40% of American families. So this affects a monstrous number of women. And it felt as though the court was quite aware that the sort of basic idea behind this statute is to protect women who are working while they're pregnant, and particularly I think in today's era, working in heavy manual labor jobs. How do we protect them, make sure that they're both safe, not being discriminated against, but also make sure that we're not paralyzing business?
So since this case happened, or since this happened to her, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission has expanded the definition of disability under the Pregnancy Discrimination Act, from what I understand. And so if the court rules against her, would that affect how the EEOC prosecutes these cases?
Well, one of the things that's so interesting is that time has moved so significantly. Not just has the EEOC amended their rules, the Justice Department has changed its posture. I mean, Donald Verrilli, the Solicitor General, had to stand up there today and explain why the Justice Department filed earlier briefs in this case where they tried to undermine Young's argument, and now they're fully on board supporting her. Now we've got 9 states that have passed laws that would guarantee women these accommodations. And as you said at the beginning, UPS has changed their own rules voluntarily. And so it's not just the EEOC, it's the sense that the culture is quickly getting to the place where Ms. Young wants them to be. It a little bit raises the question, what is in it for Young? You know, what does she recoup at the end of this? Because it looks as though policies are changing so rapidly to acknowledge exactly what her complaint is, which is that women should not have to choose between their pregnancy and their jobs.
Dahlia, thank you.
My pleasure.
That's Dahlia Lithwick. She's senior editor and legal correspondent at Slate.com. And we would love to hear what you think. Should companies be required to provide alternative work for their pregnant employees? Give us a call at 1-844-PRESSPLAY, or you can weigh in on our Facebook page, KCRW Press Play. Here in L.A., Sony Pictures is still reeling from an attack by hackers last week. The damage so far, 5 new or upcoming movies have been leaked to torrent sites. Also, a trove of information about the company and its employees, including the salaries of top Sony executives. Joining us now is Kevin Roos. He's senior editor at Fusion.net. Hi, Kevin.
Hi.
So we still don't know who did this yet, although there are various hypotheses, including North Korea as the prime actor.
Correct. Yeah, we still don't know. Sony is still investigating. They've brought in a security firm, and the FBI is also involved. And, you know, there are theories about who's behind this and how they got access to enormous troves of employee and business information from Sony Pictures. But what we do know is that there is just so much. I mean, I've been looking through these documents since Monday morning, and I'm barely scratching the surface. We're talking thousands and thousands of documents covering everything from salaries to health care benefits to hirings and firings and business strategy and budgets and things like that. It's really just a nightmare for Sony Pictures.
And this is 100 terabytes worth of information, I understand?
That's a number I've heard. I've received 26 archives, each of them about a gigabyte. So there may be more coming out in the weeks ahead, and certainly that's something that the group that's claiming credit for these hacks is saying, that more will come out. But as of yet, we just don't know how much is out there.
How did you get this information? Is it freely available?
It is. I mean, it was, at least. I got an email on Monday morning that was sent to a number of other writers as well, that was from an anonymous sender, and that said, here's a link to some information about Sony Pictures. And you click on the link, and it takes you to a Pastebin page. Pastebin is a site for anonymous pasting of documents. And that had links to a number of places to download these enormous archives. And so that's how it started. And then I just started looking through and almost immediately found a list of the salaries of over 6,000 employees of Sony Pictures.
And what did you find most surprising in that list of salaries?
Well, first of all, just how many there are. I mean, this is if not the entire company, very close to it. And what you saw as you looked at the top earners is that there was a definite gender and ethnic sort of discrepancy. Of the 17 Sony Pictures executives that were listed as having salaries of $1 million or more, 16 of them were male, and 15 of them were white. And so, I mean, this is no shocker for anyone who, you know, has studied diversity at top corporations, but you rarely see it in such stark terms with such evidence.
I guess that one would be Amy Pascal.
Exactly. She's the sort of co-head of the studio, and she was making a base salary of around $3 million a year.
And also, all the Social Security numbers, or many thousands of Social Security numbers, were also released, regular employees. What's been the reaction at Sony?
Well, from the people I've talked to there, the reaction is something between confusion and panic. I mean, people are still trying to understand exactly what happened. But right now, yeah, they're very scared. They're scared that their Social Security numbers, 3,800 Social Security numbers at least, were part of this leak. And so many employees are changing their bank passwords, are getting in touch with credit card agencies to make sure they're not going to be the victims of identity theft. There's a lot of fear and speculation swirling around at Sony Pictures right now.
What else was released? I understand that there were all sorts of internal documents related to upcoming projects. One of them was a Vince Gilligan script. He's the guy who did Breaking Bad. That was a script he wrote for a pilot that didn't get made, things like that?
Yeah, lots of internal documents. I mean, the thing that I found most shocking, well, it's hard to say what's most shocking at this point, but one of the things that stuck out to me was this spreadsheet that had performance reviews. Every employee's performance review was contained on a single spreadsheet, and these are not all flattering, you know, Joe is doing a good job. Some of these are very blunt, honest feedback about who's not measuring up and who's disappointed in who else. And these are things that, until this week, employees had never been able to see. And you can just imagine how devastating that would be to morale at a company like this.
So I wonder if employees at Sony now have access to these documents, are now going over them and learning things about their fellow workers that they shouldn't be learning.
Yeah, I would imagine that they are. I mean, I've had several Sony Pictures workers contact me and just say, you know, I'm having trouble downloading these files. Could you search for my name and tell me what it says about me?
Oh, no. And have you had to break the bad news?
Well, I haven't had time to do a ton of searching yet. I've been so focused on getting stories out about what's in these leaks. But I can imagine it being very scary. I mean, here you are working for a company, and even if you yourself have taken great pains to secure your data, even if you don't put your salary information out there or keep your information unencrypted, just the fact that you're working for this company now means that you are exposed.
So if indeed it was North Korea who did this, and that's not by any means the final conclusion that North Korea was behind this because they were angry about this upcoming Seth Rogen movie, The Interview, why would they want to release all this information, private information about rank and file employees? Or why would anyone want to?
It's not clear to me. I mean, this goes far beyond what we've seen at other corporate data breaches. It seems designed not just to embarrass Sony, but really it's a sort of a scorched earth devastation. I mean, you can't really see any public benefit from releasing the social security numbers of 3,800 employees. To me, it just seems like someone was really, really angry at Sony Pictures and decided to take it out in the most aggressive way possible.
And was Sony Pictures particularly vulnerable to this kind of hack, or are other movie studios now worried?
I'm sure other movie studios are now worried. I mean, this is an example of lax security. Having things right out there in unencrypted Excel and Word documents is just bad practice. But I'm sure that Sony Pictures is not alone in this. Obviously, there are other corporations that deal with their HR files in the same way. And so I'm guessing the IT departments at those companies are having a field day right now.
Kevin Roos, senior editor at Fusion.net, where you can read his stories about the Sony Pictures hack. Thanks, Kevin.
Thank you.
Well, let's say you could look up the salaries of all your coworkers. Would you? Why? Why not? Give us a call, 1-844-PRESSPLAY. You can leave a message or tweet us at KCRW PressPlay. Coming up, when is a person not a human? We'll ponder that question and others around the idea of personhood. That's next on Press Play.
Take KCRW with you on one of our smartphone apps. Available for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. You can stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and all our news and music streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. To be human and to be a person, they're not necessarily the same thing. While our definition of human has remained pretty constant, personhood has taken on all kinds of technical, philosophical, and legal definitions over the years. We now know, for instance, that corporations are people too. Dogs and cats have recently won certain legal rights that hinge on the idea of personhood. And the question of when a human fetus becomes a person continues to be debated in politics and religion. Virginia Hughes is a science writer. She recently devoted an entire week to this idea of personhood on her blog, Only Human. It's hosted by National Geographic. Virginia Hughes, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Well, it is my pleasure. And let me just start with this pretty open question, broad question. Why does it seem like we're so obsessed with this idea of personhood?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I'd been thinking about this a lot because I was asking myself why I was devoting so much time on my blog to writing about it. And I found this commentary written several years ago by a couple of neuroscientists who had a really good answer for it, which is essentially that we're born with the notion of personhood sort of hardwired in our brains. We're social creatures and we've kind of evolved a social brain. And so we find people everywhere we look.
So when we look at a car, for instance, we see the headlights are two eyes and the grill is the mouth, or there's a man in the moon, things like that.
Yeah. I don't know if you remember a few years back, there was this piece of grilled cheese that was being sold for thousands and thousands of dollars on eBay because the image of the Virgin Mary was in the burn marks. We see people everywhere.
We see people everywhere because we're hardwired to, just in our brains, to see people. Why? Because we need to know whether something is a predator or not, or a person?
Yeah, I think it goes well beyond that because our social development is really a crucial part of our cognitive development. And with the development of brain scanning, scientists have found particular regions of our brain that are active very specifically for looking at faces, say. There's one region that lights up for faces. So we really do seem primed for understanding a social world, and that makes sense if you believe, as I think many scientists do, that our species did so well, and you know, such a huge part of our evolution was depending, living in groups and depending on other people.
Well, and of course, philosophers have debated this idea of what makes a person since probably before Socrates. And I'm wondering if the biological discoveries of the parts of the brain that light up, as you say, when certain ideas of personhood come into being, whether that is influencing the philosophical debate over what a person is or isn't.
What philosophers do is they try to make definitions of a person. So you might say that a person is somebody who can, something that can reason, or maybe it's something that's self-aware, or maybe it's something that has memory. So those are all things that can be studied with the tools of science. But deciding what is and isn't a person, it's not something I don't think that science can determine one way or the other.
Although when it comes to end-of-life decisions, or I guess pre-life decisions, that is definitely debated, and a lot of people cite science when they decide who is and isn't a person.
Yeah, that's what initially got me thinking about this, is when the midterm elections came around, there were a couple of states that had these personhood initiatives on the ballot that were trying to give more rights to a fetus, essentially. And there's a personhood movement, a political movement, that says that life begins at conception. You know, if you ask biologists, I think the vast majority would say that that's a kind of a silly notion, because conception is actually a long process. We love to think of sperm as being this heroic fighter who's swimming forcefully toward this passive egg and then reaches the egg, and that is conception. That's actually not true. Even after the sperm reaches the egg, it takes many hours, up to 12 hours, before that sperm DNA can even find the egg DNA. And then once those two fuse, it's another couple of days before you get what's called the diploid genome, which is what we, you know, two sets of chromosomes that we consider a human. So maybe 2 days is what we should say. That's when we have a person. Except that up to 14 days in fetal development, that zygote could become twins or triplets. So you have some people saying, gosh, if this thing could become a twin in a few days, then we can't really call it a person right now. And then if you want to talk about the brain, we don't really see telltale signatures of brain waves until the fetus is about 28 weeks. I mean, some people say if we say somebody's dead when their brain is dead, then maybe that's a useful definition for life.
Hmm.
But then the fetus is born, and most of us, I think, would say they're a person then. But then I started thinking about how we treat minors and children, and most of us don't, I mean, rightly don't think that little children have complete decision-making abilities or autonomy. And so if personhood is about those things, then are little kids people? I don't know. So I think it's really hard to...
would say, yes, we are. Kids are people,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, of course. But, of course they are.
But for your definition, it goes beyond just an intellectual exercise, because we're talking about legal rights and we're talking about laws, as you mentioned. And let's talk about children, because there's this, it seems, arbitrary cutoff that when they're 18, they have full rights except to drink in the United States, which confers full personhood, right?
Yeah, the age of majority, right? When you're 18, it's like, one scholar I found said it was just like a magical night on the last night when you're 17, you suddenly become full thinking human on that day of your 18th birthday. And that's, you know, when you can go to war and you can vote and you can make your own medical decisions. But what's kind of interesting is that the medical community has started to acknowledge in the last few decades that from starting about adolescence, kids should have some say in what happens to them, what kind of medical procedures are done on them. But I was surprised. It's kind of a murky kind of a gray area.
So you reported on this for a while, and you have all these separate blog entries on different aspects of personhood. Did you come away from this with a different idea of what personhood is?
Well, I came away feeling much less clear and much more overwhelmed than I was even going in. I thought that this was just kind of going to be clarifying, and it actually turned up a lot more ambiguity and gray areas than I was expecting. So, no.
No, you still don't know what a person is.
No, I guess I don't. What do you think a person is?
I don't know. I mean, I think that you have to have some kind of sentience, if that's the right word. You have to be somewhat aware of your surroundings. You have to have some kind of intellectual or cognitive function. Otherwise, what are you?
Yeah, right. But then you could say, well, what about somebody who's 100 years old and, you know, has severe dementia and is deaf and blind and mute, and then are they a person?
Well, they have some cognitive function.
Yeah. It gets kind of tricky. It gets, you know, a lot of writings have been about people with very, very low IQ who are maybe don't have the mental capacity to quite know that.
Okay, I'm confused too. Virginia Hughes, her blog is called Only Human, hosted by National Geographic. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Madeline.
Coming up, the story of a woman who was raised white and Jewish and found out she's black. She found out in college how she found out and what she learned about her family and about race in America after a news update with Eric Roy.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Lacey Schwartz grew up in Woodstock, New York. Her parents are white, but she has darker skin and tight black curly hair. Her dad explained by pointing to an old picture of his Sicilian grandfather. But as Lacey grew up, she had her doubts, and she embarked on a journey to find out the truth. The result is shown in a new documentary by her. It's called Little White Lie.
I come from a long line of New York Jews. I grew up in a world with synagogue, Hebrew school, bar mitzvahs, so it never occurred to me that I was passing. I wasn't pretending to be something I wasn't. I actually grew up believing I was white.
And Lacey Schwartz joins me now. Welcome.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So this is a very, very personal story of your family, of your identity, of finding out who you are, of uncovering, as you say in the title, the little, maybe not so little white lie. Why did you want to explore this in such a public fashion?
When I first started out, I actually was not going to make this movie. I started out thinking that I wanted to make a movie about being black and Jewish. And I started actually filming that and moving forward with that and realized that I couldn't actually integrate my identity until I dealt with my family secret.
So when you have the scenes of confronting your parents, those are scenes that are happening in real time.
Yeah, exactly.
Dad, it's no secret that Mommy had an affair.
Did she ever tell you she did?
She never talked to me even about that. And da-da-da-da-da-da-da, and life goes on. Her merry way of poor communication and chaos and I mean, don't you think she should have told me?
Yeah.
When did you first realize that you were not like the rest of your family, that something was different?
You know, I think for me, one of the large themes in this film is the power of denial. And so specifically, my kind of timeline of denial, I think, goes from where my parents split up when I'm 16. And I think probably deep down, from that point until when I actually have conversation with my mother, who tells me the truth, which happens after my freshman year of college, there's more or less a 3-year period where I'm slowly realizing the truth, but I'm not really willing to admit it to myself.
But even before then, you had a few clues. A woman comes up to you at your bat mitzvah and says, oh, it's so nice that there's an Ethiopian Jew in the family.
Absolutely. There were definitely clues beforehand. But I think that, like others in my family, I was trying to protect this family unit. And I think part of the piece about denial is before you lie to other people, a lot of times you lie to yourself. You know, until my parents broke up and I started questioning a lot of things, I really did believe that I was their child.
So you get to college and you had applied to Georgetown.
Mm-hmm.
And there's the box where you check your race.
Exactly.
And you left it blank.
Right.
Why?
You know, at that point, my parents had split up. And then shortly after my parents split up, I started dating somebody who was biracial. When we would walk down the street, people would say, oh, you look like your brother and sister.
I have such a profound memory of looking at your family pictures and being like, come on. This is like, you would have the pictures coming back from Jamaica with the braid. And you get so dark. But how absurd it read to me, even as, you know, I was 16 years old or something like that. I wasn't like a man of the world or anything. Your family, your cousins and stuff, and everyone was, even the adults?
They heard the story and they went with it.
White people will think anything. Crazy things. I'll know white people for a long time. It'll just be like, wow.
I think that period of time is when my denial starts to come undone.
So you get to college and you had not checked the box because you were confused yourself, but you still had not fully wanted to admit to yourself what was eventually that you found out to be the truth.
Right. I mean, there was a period of time where I was seriously, I think, questioning my identity, but I didn't have anything to replace it with. So I didn't, at that point, it felt strange to check a box saying white because I became fairly aware of how other people looked at me, but I didn't have anything else to replace it with. So I didn't check any box.
And you get to college,
mm-hmm.
you get to Georgetown, and instantly you are accepted into this black student group.
Well, what happened was that I had to submit a photograph as part of my application. They asked for a photograph, and Georgetown admitted me as a black student based off of that photograph.
That wasn't so long ago, but it seems absurd that they would just categorize you based on a photograph.
Yeah. This was 1993, 94. So there was no option to be kind of multiracial at that time at all.
So you go to this club and then describe what it feels like to be part of this club.
It was, you know, mixed emotions, but there was a way in which I felt very welcomed. You know, some of the difference that I was really struggling with felt very accepted in that space. And there was this period of time in this freshman year of college where Georgetown admitted me as a black student. I was invited kind of into the black community, but I didn't have any claim to blackness in any sense. So I did put myself in that space, but I didn't outwardly claim it. You know, I was pretty honest with people and I just said, I would say both my parents are white and I'm not sure why I look the way I do.
Oh, okay.
And that was the truth.
But you had no experience being black growing up. So how did you, I guess, learn to be black,
mm-hmm.
for lack of a better way of putting it? Mm-hmm. How did you become black on the inside?
You know, I think that it's also about like the naming of it, right? So I think I grew up with this embodying this idea of difference. So I didn't name it as black. But then when I found out the truth, I put the name of blackness on that.
But there are cultural sort of norms, I guess, mm-hmm. within certain groups, cultural ways of being that maybe outsiders don't understand or know mm-hmm. much about. And so I imagine there are cultural ways of being black that white people don't really know or understand. And so how did you know and understand those ways of being
black? Well, some
of
it, I mean, as I say in the film, like college was like race 101 for me. I mean, I think there were certain things that felt very natural and very comfortable for me. And there were other things that I kind of learned. I mean, you know, I was born right at the time where honestly some of the like black culture was starting to seep in. I wouldn't say into mainstream culture. It's not like it is now. But I was like up on black culture. You know, I knew the music. I was relatively familiar with black culture, you know, growing up through my own kind of likes and tastes.
Mm-hmm.
But I think when I went away to college and was in a space that was really where I felt comfortable. And I say in the film, there were things I was nervous about, like, am I going to, you know, how do I talk different? Do I also, you know, how do I dance in certain songs or whatever it is? But, you know, one of the things I think was really interesting for me was that within the Black community, I was not the only person who had not grown up around other Black people. You know, other members of my class also had been, like, the people in the Black community had also been, you know, one of the only people of color in their honors classes in their high school.
If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with Lacey Schwartz. She's directed a new, very personal documentary called Little White Lie about finding out that she had a Black father, Black biological father. When did you first say to yourself, I'm Black?
I said it after I spoke to my mother, and she confirmed that my biological father was Black.
Lacey would ask, how come you never talked to me about it? How come nobody ever talked to me about it?
And I said to her, Mom, you have to tell me.
How come nobody saw that I was different? How come nobody thought enough to come to me and say, I know the truth?
And for whatever reason, I decided that was the moment.
She was pinning me, and she wasn't letting me go.
Before that, you did not think of yourself as a Black woman.
I didn't, no.
And now you do.
I do, yeah.
How soon after you talked to your mom did you fully internalize that and say, okay, this is who I am?
Well, I think, you know, a lot of these events, like even the Georgetown admitting me as a Black student, or my mother then finally giving me kind of the answer, they were confirmation. So I think I wasn't willing to say to myself before that, I identify as being Black, but I had a hunch, to say the least.
But you are biracial.
Yeah.
So you're biologically half Black, half uh-huh. white. So why do you identify as Black?
You know, I think for me, I look at being biracial as a category of being Black. You know, it's almost this idea of being kind of a person of color. I think we currently live in a country where whiteness is almost it's the norm, it's the neutral. And that might not be something that lasts forever, that I feel forever. But right now in the country that we live in and the way that race exists and the conversations are had, I identify as being part of kind of that otherness.
And do you think you identify with the other because when you were growing up, you thought of yourself as the other, you were different?
Yeah, definitely.
How do you think it would have changed or been different, your story, if your mother had had an affair with a white man?
Well, I mean, there's obviously the question of whether or not the truth would have come out.
But I wonder if there was an added, I don't know, shame element on the part of your parents. Was your mother ashamed that she had had an affair with a Black man? More so than, I don't know if you can prove a negative, more so than she would have been had he been white? And that's why she kept it secret?
Well, I mean, I'll say this. I don't think that if she had had an affair with a white man, she would have been more willing to admit it. I don't personally look at it like my mother has shame around the fact that she had had an affair with a Black man. But what I do think is that it didn't fit into her world. And I think that there were like a lot of boundaries around who she was and where she came from and kind of how things were supposed to be. But with regards to, you know, I truly feel, you know, just as accepted as I always have been within my family. Like, I don't think that there is any sense of, like, rejection of me because that I'm Black. But I think that for me, a lot of this comes down to the difference between racism and race consciousness. And so it's not that I think that my family, in particular my mother, felt shameful of who I was or having an affair with a Black man. I just think that they were kind of blissfully ignorant, and that was in certain ways damaging.
So much of what I did was connected to who I was, and nobody talked about who I was. I can't talk to Daddy about who I am. I can't talk to Daddy about who I am in terms of, you know, it's not that like being Black is everything, but it's part of who I am. And if I can't share all of who I am with him, and why can't I share all of him with him? Because you had an affair, because nobody talked about everything, because it was all secrets.
So you're married now, and do you have kids yet?
I do.
You do?
I do. I have 15-month-old twins.
Oh, congratulations.
Thank you.
Boy and girl.
Identical twin boys.
Oh, boy. So what are you going to talk to them about when you have to raise this issue and talk about race and your background, their background?
Yeah.
How are you going to talk about it with them?
Again, I'm a first-time parent, so it's hard for me to totally, completely think that through. But I just think this idea of raising your kids so that they know who they are, you know. I mean, it's interesting in a sense because I am married to somebody who's Black, you know, and we're a Black family and my in-laws are Black. So that will come through. I don't have to, you know, I don't have to kind of inform that in a different way. It'll kind of come through in a lived experience of being part of a mixed family. I mean, my family by marriage is very mixed. So when we're all together, it's a mixed situation. So it kind of embodies who I am. So I think that won't be that confusing for them.
Well, Anwar, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
That's Lacey Schwartz. She's the director of the new documentary. It's called Little White Lie. It's playing at the Lemley Music Hall in Beverly Hills all this week. And it's going to air on Independent Lens on PBS next year. And if you want more information, go to the website littlewhitelythefilm.com. Hello, Warren Olney.
Hello there.
What do you have for us at 1 o'clock?
We are going to talk at length with five different women about the situation today at the U.S. Supreme Court. I should say four different women and one man, not to mention me, about the argument at the Supreme Court today about discrimination against pregnant women in the workplace. And it's very interesting how different their ideas are, although all of them, of course, are all in favor of pregnant women and making sure that they are able to stay in the workplace. I think the main message is that things have changed so radically since the Discrimination Act against pregnant women changed in or was enacted in 1978.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That we haven't caught up yet.
Well, a lot more women in the workplace, for sure.
To say the least.
Since then, and a lot more women supporting their families as the sole or primary breadwinner.
That's right. And arguments about on the part of business. We have one woman who filed an amicus brief with the Supreme Court on behalf of business, saying that this creates problems for small businesses in particular, because they really don't have the resources mm-hmm. to be able to replace somebody or replace that person's duties or get somebody else to help them when they become pregnant.
Robots. The answer to all of our ills. Robots. Warren Olney, thank you. That's at 1 o'clock and to the point. And coming up on this show, the inventor of the pop-up ad is really, really sorry for what he has done to you. We'll have that and other internet news with the guys from Reply All next on Press Play.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Los Angeles. We rely on listeners like you. Support the podcasts you love by becoming a member. Go to kcrw.com/join.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Racism, it's bad, and there are people on the internet who want to put an end to it. So that's good, right? Well, it kind of depends on how you go about it. And this being the internet, it will not surprise you to hear that some vigilantes are going about it in a pretty questionable way. Here to explain, Alex Goldman, who co-hosts the new podcast, Reply All. It's a show all about the internet. Hi, Alex.
Hi.
All right, so this story starts with a site called Racists Getting Fired. So that's a site that tries to get racist people fired from their jobs, I guess. So all good so far?
I mean, it depends on what you mean by all good.
The intent, I should say.
Sure, I think the intent of pointing out when people are, say, reprehensible things on the internet is noble, but the premise of it essentially is if people say things that are racist on their Twitter feed, on their Facebook feed, this blog highlights that and uses their real names to try and encourage people on the internet to then call their employers and have them fired.
Well, what could go wrong?
Quite a bit. This all sort of took off around Ferguson, and a lot of the commentary people are making is about what's going on in Ferguson and the racial dynamics thereof. And last week, a guy sent in fake images from an ex-girlfriend's Facebook to Racists Getting Fired and had them posted on there. She works at an AMC theater, and the AMC theater was then flooded with people threatening to boycott if they don't fire her and accusing her of all these reprehensible things, none of which she did. And I mean, I feel like the people who created Racists Getting Fired probably should have anticipated this happening.
So Racists Getting Fired, this site, doesn't vet these things?
You know, it's really hard to vet things like this. I mean, a lot of times Facebook is behind a password. A lot of times Twitter accounts are protected. This is stuff that I think they put up simply because they feel more righteous indignation than they do actual justified anger about certain people's behavior. And since this happened, racists getting fired have basically said, like, we want to hand this site over to someone who can be responsible with vetting. But if you're creating something like this, like, you should know from the beginning that it's sort of your job to be responsible, right?
Right, that you're going to unleash a torrent of hate. But so why don't they just take it down?
I don't know, because I think that they think that this is a correct use of the internet. The best way to keep people from behaving badly is by pointing out they're behaving badly.
Right. Except when they're not behaving badly.
Right.
Yeah. Okay, let's move on to this story that will maybe tug on the heartstrings or the nostalgia strings of anyone who spent a lot of time behind Windows 95. Microsoft is getting out of the clip art business. And do we need to explain what clip art is first?
I don't know. I suppose that maybe that dates me that I don't think that we do. But if we do, clip art is just a bunch of sort of very low-res images that used to come with Microsoft products that you could insert in PowerPoint presentations or in Word documents to sort of jazz them up a little bit.
Like a winking saxophone or something?
Yeah.
Or a happy flower?
Uh-huh. Or like a computer in a window with the sun shining above it. They were all sort of these varied hackney things that were meant to connote certain emotions, I suppose.
And why is Microsoft getting out of the clip art business?
Well, once upon a time, clip art were the only images you could find easily on your computer. And then Google came along, and as Microsoft assumes, Bing came along. And now people, when they want to insert something in one of their PowerPoint presentations, they just go to Google Image Search, and they can call up every picture in the known universe. And they don't need little representations of certain things anymore, because they can get those exact things online.
So I imagine now there's going to be a booming business for Microsoft clip art, right?
I think what's going to happen is there's going to be repositories of people who keep these pieces of clip art alive. But what's really going on is that Microsoft has provided these sort of detailed instructions on how to get Creative Commons licensed photos. So that if you ever need a photo for your presentation, you can get it off the internet and it won't be breaking the law, which is very sweet of them, but I'm going to miss those sort of silly clip art images.
Okay, let's move on. You guys talked on your podcast this week with Ethan Zuckerman, the man who invented the much reviled internet pop-up ad, and he said he's sorry. So let's listen to a clip from your interview.
I really did not mean to break the internet. I really did not mean to bring this horrible thing into people's lives. I really am extremely sorry about this. We were trying to solve a problem that may turn out actually to be unsolvable. How do you monetize user-generated content without implicitly endorsing that content?
What does he mean by that?
Well, he told us a great story during the interview where he had some people. He worked at Tripod, which is an old website that used to allow you. It was sort of like one of the first do-it-yourself kind of websites. And he had some folks go to Ford and try and sell them on advertising on Tripod. And they randomly selected a Tripod site because there was a random button. And it happened to have a lot of pornography on it. So they were in this presentation, and they popped up a bunch of pornography for these Ford executives who, like, lost their mind. And Ford basically said, we want to be able to advertise on your site, but without actually being associated with your content. And they tried to think of the simplest way to do that, and they were like, well, what if it pops up in a separate window? Doesn't that give them enough plausible deniability that they're not actually advertising next to our things? So that's how he invented the pop-up ad.
But why is he sorry? Because we all hate it?
Because the pop-up, he's upset. He's sorry for a number of reasons. And I have to say, to be fair to Ethan Zuckerman, he may have been the inventor of the pop-up ad, but he's also an internet activist. He's the director of the MIT Center for Civic Media. He's done a lot in the 20 years mm-hmm. since he created the pop-up. But he's sorry because he says that basically at that time, we had a choice. We could have gone down the road of an internet that's supported by ads, or maybe some kind of different internet where the internet is maybe supported by subscriptions. And we have as time has gone on, since ads have become less valuable, given up more and more of our personal privacy and our data to these advertisers. And he says it's sort of like the original sin of the internet. The pop-up ad was the thing that allowed us to go down this road that makes a story like Edward Snowden no longer surprising.
Well, if you want to hear more from that interview with Ethan Zuckerman, you can. Tonight, you can download the latest episode of Reply All. That's the new podcast that Alex Goldman and his co-host, PJ Vogt, are producing. And it's great. You should definitely subscribe. It's free at iTunes. Alex, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Also free, it's free to comment on our Facebook page. And Julie Myers, we got some comments today.
I wish they were done in clip art form. You know,
yeah, me
the
too.
Like cartoon looking turkey and some like pilgrim looking stick figure. Apparently I'm caught on Thanksgiving here. So if you want to do that, you can go to our Facebook page just
what
for
about
me.
The little paper clips? Is that going to go away too?
I Clippy, like that. I think Clippy's been dead for a few years.
Aww.
Yeah. He was never a person either.
Really?
Just to throw back to the personhood. Hey, let's get to some feedback here. Sorry, I got off track. We talked about this giant Sony hack. All the salaries of Sony workers were leaked. And so we wanted to know what you all would do if the salaries at your company were leaked. A lot of people weighed in. Gina Leslie says she would not want to look at the salaries of her coworkers. It would just infuriate her, she says. She's pretty sure that men who were hired years after her to do the same work make more money than her, and there's not much she can do about it, so she does not want to know. Joseph Short Glass tweeted us, and he also doesn't want to know, but it's because he trusts that he's getting paid fairly for the work that he does. Looking at the pay of coworkers just creates a hostile workforce. Mike McGill on Facebook says he's sure the leak at Sony is going to cause all sorts of infighting. He recalls that a while back, the LA Times published LAUSD administrator salaries and that it was pretty contentious at the workplace after that. But Rick Vilchis points out that there are plenty of companies that already publish the salaries of employees. I guess Whole Foods is one of them. And the reasoning is that if it's all out in the open, no one can come up with conspiracy theories about how some people are making more than others, you know, that kind of thing. Ani Sakyan Peck says she would for sure look at what her coworkers make, and then she'd demand a raise from her boss.
Oh, well, there you go. All right, you can weigh in on that if you want on Twitter, at KCRW Press Play, Facebook, KCRW Press Play. Julie Myers, I'm not going to ask how much you make. I don't want to know.
So I do this out of love.
All right. Thanks, everyone, for listening. And Warren Olney to The Point up next, so don't go anywhere. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.